In 2015, we said goodbye to a number of remarkable Iowans. This hour, we remember a number of them. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This time of year, we like to look back and remember some Iowans in our news that we lost, figures we know from many different fields who died in 2015, including native Iowan, the Reverend Robert Schuller, one of the original pioneers of the megachurch movement. Also, Raptor specialist Bob Anderson, former Lieutenant Governor Art New, and many others. Remembering some Iowans from our news who passed away in 2015. First, this news from NPR. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Well, at this time of year, we like to look back at the previous year and remember some Iowans in our news that we lost, figures that we know from many different fields, and that's what we'll be doing throughout the hour. Joining me, first of all, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent, who has covered politics in Iowa for decades. And Dean is joining me to talk about some of the passing of several Iowa political figures that we want to mark to start off this hour. Hi, Dean.
Hey, Ben.
In January of 2015, former Iowa Lieutenant Governor Art New died at the age of 81. Mm-hmm. He also served as a regent, the mayor of Carroll, Iowa. He was, as a matter of fact, the first chair of the Iowa Public Radio Board of Directors. This is a man with an amazing record of public service.
He just thrived on serving people, and he was that sort of a gentleman, and I emphasize an underscored gentleman.
What does that mean for you? I mean, what do you mean by that?
He was very intelligent, but never held that above anybody else. If he was a good friend of mine, you might say that he never held his intelligence over mine. But I just enjoyed working with Art and called him a close friend. I first encountered Art New in the Iowa legislature back in the 1960s, and then he went on to be Lieutenant Governor, Robert Ray's Lieutenant Governor, and then, as you say, went on to degrees of public service. The Iowa Board of Corrections, the Iowa Board of Regents, Iowa Public Radio's first board, as you've already said, and some of those things, especially the Board of Regents and the Iowa Public Radio, groundbreaking forming of the Iowa Public Radio network as we know it now, wasn't easy.
Mm-hmm. And he served there as sort of the wise voice of many years of experience.
Yep.
Tell us a little bit more about the role that Art New played under as lieutenant governor under Bob Ray.
Well, the role of lieutenant governor at that time was not the same as it is now in the prominence that Governor Branstad is giving his current lieutenant governor. And Art New was a very capable person, having been in the legislature. And so Bob Ray used him a lot in liaison with legislators. So he had a role, but it wasn't as deputy governor.
Mm-hmm. Past his professional experience, you mentioned you're a close friend. You were a close friend to Art New. What do you most remember about him as a person?
Well, I just repeat again, very soft-spoken, but a real Renaissance person. He loved public service. He liked classical music. He was a skilled photographer, amateur historian. What more can you say about this man? He just goes on and on with his avocations and his vocation as an attorney. Mm-hmm. And Art New also was a passionate fan of Northwestern football. He would drive from Carroll, Iowa, his home, to Chicago just to see the Northwestern Wildcats, who didn't really have winning records at that time.
Yes.
And Art New was because he was a graduate of Northwestern Law School.
Dean Borg with us, remembering some political figures who passed in 2015. Let's talk about David Stanley, also a person you counted as a friend in August of 2015. David Stanley, heir to one of Iowa's largest fortunes and a longtime conservative activist. He died at the age of 86, a native of Muscatine. ran for the Iowa House, spent years in the legislature, twice ran for the Senate, both times losing in 68 and 74.
Lost to John Culver and Harold Hughes. First Harold Hughes in 1968 and John Culver then in 1974.
However, his political influence lasted for decades as a leader of Iowans for Tax Relief. Tell us some more about his activism.
Well, when he was in the legislature, passionate conservative, and he was Senate Majority Leader during his time in the Iowa Senate between 1964 and 1969 is when he served in the Senate, and toward the latter part of that service in the Senate was the Republican Senate Majority Leader, went back to the House of Representatives a few years later. But overall, 12 years there. But passionate conservative, and as I remember him standing on the floor of the Iowa Senate, just very outspoken, very determined at saving money wherever he possibly could.
Do you, as a friend of his, yes. Do you know where that impetus came from, that grounding in saving money came from?
I think it was from his very conservative Christian background, because that was another passion of his life. Politics, and then the organization Iowans for Tax Relief, and he served on many boards, including Iowa Wesleyan College Board of Trustees, but he served on many boards. In fact, there was a lawsuit in the family, the Stanley family, with some of the family filing suit against David Stanley and his wife for using some of the family, if I can say, fortune or treasure in avocation and contributing to the tax relief, and also for Christian organizations. Mm-hmm. They thought that he had overspent some of what money belonged to the family.
As a friend of David Stanley, what would you say about him personally as a friend?
He is a very nice gentleman. He was, again, I use the word gentleman to Art New and David Stanley. But David Stanley was always with a smile on his face, but he was a little bit aloof. Art New was more just a friend, you know.
Approachable.
Approachable is a good word. David Stanley, not so much so, because he very highly principled and a little bit more reserved. Let me tell you a story about Dave Stanley. We had him when he was prominent in the Iowa legislature, and perhaps it was when he was running for U.S. Senate, I can't remember which, but we had him scheduled as a guest on Iowa Press in early May.
On Iowa Public Television.
Yes. And we waited at the scheduled time to tape the show. We waited and we waited and we waited. And finally, Dave Stanley walks into the studio, and his first words out of his mouth were, "I'm sorry to keep you guys waiting," he said. "It's Mother's Day." And one of our panelists said, "We've all got mothers."
And how did he react to that?
He smiled and sat down and did the interview without responding. That was Dave Stanley.
Let's also talk about Art Small. Art Small died also in this past year, 2015, at the age of 81. Former state legislator, U.S. Senate candidate. Also here in Iowa, remembered by many as a sort of Renaissance man. Many, many different passions and interests.
But, you know, what all these have in common, they all served in the Iowa legislature during the late 1960s and early 70s. They all were law graduates, Art Small and Dave Stanley from the University of Iowa, Art New, as I've said, from Northwestern. And Art Small, as you've said, is just a very dry humor in this gentleman. In fact, one of his campaigns slogan was, "Think big, vote small." And he called his a small campaign.
Thank you for remembering some of the political figures, celebrating their lives, political figures that passed from our midst in 2015. You wanted to add, Dean?
One more thing.
Yes.
That when he was in retirement center in Iowa City, one of his longtime, very close friends under the now leaving office Bill Gluba, mayor of Davenport. Bill Gluba and Art Small were good, close Democrat friends from the Iowa legislature. And Bill Gluba would come to visit Art at the retirement center here, and once a month they would have lunch together at the retirement center, just like clockwork. It was set on schedule.
Okay. Thank you very much, Dean Borg, Iowa Public Radio correspondent, also longtime host of Iowa Public Television's Iowa Press, covering politics in Iowa for many decades. Thank you for these remembrances, Dean.
It's nice to talk with you, Ben.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're taking note of some of the more prominent Iowans we lost in 2015. Perhaps you have someone you'd like us to remember. You can go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page and put your remembrance there. Well, in sports, one of the all-time greats in Big Ten basketball history died in September of 2015. Roy Marble was only 48 years old when he died of cancer. Les Jepson was one of Roy Marble's teammates for 4 years. He joins us now. Hi, Les.
Hi, how are you doing?
I'm fine. It was in the 1980s that you played with Roy Marble, I believe, and at that time he became the all-time leading scorer in the University of Iowa history. He spent 2 years in the pros. What kind of player was Roy?
Well, I saw every point he scored. I mean, he was a terrific player from day one. When he came on campus, like we were all freshmen in 1985, and I mean, he adapted to the Big Ten game real fast, and he was the best player on the court our first game in Hawaii.
Mm-hmm. And this was right from his freshman year.
Yeah, right. I mean, first game. I think he scored exactly 14 points. Remember the game like yesterday. And he's the best player on the court. He played at Hawaii Hilo, and he was terrific.
Was that a surprise in that game?
You know, I think so because you know we were all freshmen at the time, and he was struggling like any freshman, you know, all freshmen do. But all of a sudden, you know, the preseason things went away, and all of a sudden that first game, he just shined. He was the best player on the court.
Mm-hmm.
He was that way the rest of his career there at Iowa.
There are good collegiate basketball players, and there are great players. Roy was certainly one of the greats. What made him so?
Well, he had a competitive drive. You know, his competitive drive was like any, you know, great pro, like a Michael Jordan or a Kobe Bryant. He had that same drive, and he was blessed to be in an environment where he had guys like Glenn Rice, Loy Vaught, Terry Mills, B.J. Armstrong in his peer circle when he was in high school. And so that competitive drive, you got a bunch of, you know, world-class athletes at 15, 16, 17 years old. He wanted to be the best out of that group, and he was right there. So,
and this was growing up in Michigan.
Yeah, Flint, Michigan. Yep.
You talk about his drive, though. To build on that, he worked hard for his success. It just didn't happen by itself, did it?
Well, he was a natural athlete to begin with. I mean, he transcended, you know, most normal, you know, people, even athletes. But when he got in the court every day, he worked hard. And over the course of, you know, 4 or 5 years, he developed into an even better player than he was when he got on campus.
Mm-hmm.
He worked hard. Yeah.
How was he as a team player? How did he inspire the rest of the team?
Well, you know, he led by example, I think, on the court. He didn't like to lose, and he wanted to win every game, and he wanted to be that guy that, you know, made the right play at the right time to win the game. And you know, again, he led by example on the court.
Do you have any other memories of Roy Marble that stand out?
Well, I mean, we played in the CBA.
Which is the what?
The Continental Basketball Association. It's like the NDBL, mm-hmm. the NBA.
All right.
We played 1 year in the mid-90s. And, you know, he was working hard to try to make it back into the NBA. And, you know, I remember the day he got called up by the Nuggets, Denver Nuggets. And that was a big win in his career because he worked hard to get to the NBA, and he had a little bit of a setback, but he got back. So that was good. That was great to see him succeed.
Taken from us at a fairly early age, at 48 years old, do you have a conversation, and have you spoken with him recently for his death?
Yeah, I did. I mean, we always stayed in touch. We got together in Indianapolis when his son played two or three times, and we had a great time. Saw the game, and we got together after the game. And we texted back and forth while his son was playing. Anytime I came to Iowa City, he was there. And, you know, he was sick for just a short amount of time.
Mm-hmm.
But we stayed in touch. he was a great friend. He was a great player. And, you know, sometimes I think people misunderstood him a little bit, but he was a good man.
Thank you very much, Les Jepson, one of Roy Marble's teammates during his time at the Hawkeyes. And Roy Marble, 48 years old when he passed, died of cancer in 2015. Another loss from the Iowa sports family this year was Reverend Bob Holzhammer, the voice of the Iowa Hawkeyes for 25 years as a PA announcer for basketball and football. Here he is announcing the lineup at an Iowa women's basketball game.
Here come the Hawkeyes! Hello, everyone. Welcome to Carver Hawkeye Arena and Big Ten basketball between the Boilermakers from Purdue University and our own University of Iowa Hawkeyes.
And here he is discussing his legacy there.
It was in the spring of 1974, late spring, when my predecessor, Bud Suter, had passed away, and the athletic administrators, Bump Elliott, at that time, was looking for someone to do the PA. And how he ever heard about me, I had done some games when I was my first pastorate in Iowa Falls, but Bump asked me if I would do the spring game. Bobby Cummings had just come as our new football coach. And so, unbeknown to me, I guess, it was kind of an audition, because after the game was over, Bump asked me if I would be free to do the games in the fall. And that was when I assured him that no one in our congregation ever got married or died when the Hawkeyes were playing, so I would be available to do the games. Well, I have a lot of fond memories. Probably one that kind of sticks in my mind, and one that's kind of on the minds of a lot of people right now, is back in 1980, when the Hawks beat Georgetown and were coming home for the getting ready to go to the Final Four, and we had that big deal over in the field house with, 15,000 people. And I'd miss the relationships that we've had with the coaches and with the players. Because of my professional background, I kind of on occasions have been unofficial chaplain to some of the students, some of the athletes. I've officiated at marriages of some of them, and now I'm even baptizing their children, so that tells you kind of how long we've been around.
Bob Holzhammer died on March 25th, 2015. He was 92 years old. Some other losses known to Iowa sports fans in 2015. Jackson Vroman was found dead in his pool in June of last year after apparently hitting his head. Vroman was star of the Iowa State University basketball team from 2002 to 2004. He was a second-round NBA draft selection by the Chicago Bulls. He then played two NBA seasons with the New Orleans, Oklahoma City, Phoenix. He continued to play with the Lebanon national basketball team until 2014. He died at age 34. Hawkeye football standout Tyler Sash died of an accidental overdose. That was in September of last year. A beloved part of the University of Iowa's 2009 football team, he helped beat Georgia Tech in the Orange Bowl, earning all Big Ten honors twice while with the Hawkeyes. An amazing safety. After graduating, Sash went on to win the Super Bowl with the New York Giants. Tyler Sash was just 27 years old. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. We're remembering people who passed away in 2015, notable Iowans. Perhaps you have someone you'd like to remember. All you need to do to make us aware of that is go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page and tell us about that person. One of the biggest Iowa court cases of 2014 was the trial of Benton McKenzie, a terminal cancer patient who says he grew marijuana to extract cannabis oil to treat a painful tumor. When he died in January of 2015, the fight for legal cannabis oil continued. Last year, I talked with News and City Hall reporter for the Quad City Times, Brian Wellner, about the impact of McKenzie's death. Wellner described the legacy of Benton's case.
Benton's case, I mean, it was unique to him, but also spoke to the broader issue of medical marijuana and the rights of patients to access an alternative form of treatment where maybe traditional methods either aren't working or aren't working well enough.
McKenzie's family has vowed to continue Benton McKenzie's fight for legalization of cannabis oil. The state legislature is expected to debate the legality of manufacture within the state this upcoming session. Benton McKenzie died January 12th at the age of 49. Bob Anderson died in 2015. He was director of the Raptor Resource Project. That's a nonprofit group located in Bluffton, Iowa. It boasts the internationally known Decorah Eagle Cam. And Anderson joined us on the program multiple times to discuss the eagles and other birds. Let's listen back to an interview I recorded with him in January of last year.
Well, we've had a pair of great horned owls that have taken a liking to the Decorah Eagle nest. The eagles are often in it during the day, but at night it's being visited by a pair of great horned owls. And about a week ago, one of the eagles saw an owl in the nest in the middle of the night, and it went in to chase it away. And then it was actually the mate of that particular owl struck the male bald eagle so hard it knocked it right out of the nest. And all that was captured on video, and it's shocking.
Right.
It's absolutely shocking. Now, this morning I got up, and I can review every 3 hours we've got recorded video, and sure enough, we had an owl in the nest for quite a bit last night.
Okay. So we have a little bit of sound from the video captured by your cameras there. Let's listen. I think this is from the first attempted takeover that you described at first. Let's listen. So, Bob, what did we hear there?
Well, you heard the male owl in the nest hooting, and then off in the background, a lower voice, that was the female responding. And then you heard the eagle kind of scream and chitter. The eagle flew into the nest. The owl saw it coming and made his escape. But his mate, the female who was off in the distance, who you could hear responding to his hooting, came across the screen at Mach 5 and knocked the eagle right off the nest. It was shocking, shocking.
At Mach 5, that's an exaggeration a little bit, right?
Well, it probably is. I mean, if you follow this, it's a blur. It's a blur. It's happened so fast that you see something coming across screen and strike the eagle.
Mm-hmm. Has this ever been caught on tape before? Did we know this happened in nature?
You know, no. Because we have color day and infrared night cameras and microphones, we're kind of learning some new things into species that have been studied for a long, long time. That's what makes it kind of fun. We've discovered that the eagles can be active at night, and now we're surprised to see the great horned owls are actually trying to take over ownership of the nest. Without the cameras, we would not know this. It's only because we have the cameras that we are getting insight into this strange behavior, which, as far as I know, has never been witnessed or documented before.
Right, and so has there been a lot of interest from raptor biologists around the world, I imagine?
You know, there is. There's a lot of interest. There really are, and it's very possible that we might have a Decorah Great Horned Owl Cam this year instead of a Decorah Bald Eagle Cam. It's shocking. You know, will we step in and do something? No, we're not. We're just going to let nature work it out and enjoy the ride and learn. And I think a lot of people are quite interested in what's going to transpire, what's going to happen.
A conversation with Bob Anderson in January of last year. Anderson died on July 27th. He was 65 years old. When we return in just a few minutes, we continue our remembrance of a number of remarkable Iowans we said goodbye to in 2015, including native Iowan, the Reverend Robert Schuller, one of the original pioneers of the megachurch movement, also Burns Weston, a pioneer of international human rights. That's all coming up in the second half hour. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we're taking note of some of the prominent Iowans we lost in 2015. 2015 saw the passing of one of America's most successful televangelists, someone who used to call his church a shopping center for Jesus Christ. Robert Schuller was born near Alton, Iowa in 1926. He was the fifth child of Dutch immigrant parents who lived in a farmhouse without electricity or plumbing. And he died this past year at the age of 88. The silver-haired evangelist rose from these humble beginnings to become one of the late 20th century's most recognized religious figures. Robert Schuller created the weekly Hour of Power television show. At its peak, It attracted an international audience of millions. He built the Crystal Cathedral in Garden Grove, California, as the embodiment of an upbeat, modern vision of Christianity. He also wrote dozens of books. However, in the end, his ministry was shattered by family discord and financial ruin. Michael Nason is with us, a close friend to the Reverend Robert Schuller and an aide to him for 40 years, also former executive producer of Hour of Power. Michael Nason, so good you could join us.
Thank you very much for the invitation.
Tell us how and when you met the Reverend.
It was 1972. I was working on Richard Nixon's campaign for president. I was the Orange County staff guy, and we needed someone to give an invocation at an event. I invited Reverend Schuller. He accepted. He and I met. He and I sort of hit it off that evening at dinner, and he and I would touch base over the next several weeks and months, and for about 6 months, I advised him. He asked me for help with some of the things he was doing in his work at the church. And the next thing I know, in 1973, he asked me to come to work for him full time.
From those early meetings, did you have an idea, a vision of what he might become, what he might come to represent?
No, not at all. I was a little taken back by Robert Schuller at the time because I was raised in a very mainline church. There was no showbiz kind of field church. And when I met up with Robert Schuller and I attended his church for the first time, I realized that it was a very alive church, a very connected church. People seemed to be wanting to be there all the time. And so that surprised me. So I had to adjust to being a mainline Episcopalian to being in a more evangelical base.
Robert Schuller is recognized as one of the original pioneers of what is called the mega church movement.
Mm-hmm.
Tell us, how did the Hour of Power grow into what became a movement?
Well, I think there was a need, and he filled it. If you recall, or you may not recall, you're probably too young, but in the early parts of television, Bishop Sheen was on television at the time. It was extremely successful and was on network television on the DuPont network. And when he started to disappear from the screens, there was a niche there that I think was missing. And it was Dr. Billy Graham who advised Dr. Schuller to take his church service, which he felt was so dynamic, to television. It was actually Billy Graham who even named the program Hour of Power. He says, Bob, I have the hour of decision. You should have the hour of power.
So what was it about his preaching? What about the Reverend was so special when it came to reaching people through television?
Well, I think that he tapped into an emotional need from people on a spiritual level that was different than what they were getting. And I think what happened was he took theology, psychology, and a little bit of entertainment and packaged it into a program that was very, very appealing. And the format worked. I mean, we obviously had a church service. We had the choir. But the things that would people would walk away remembering would be the interviews from people whose lives have been changed through Christ and wanted to share those. And those became highlight moments, the guest soloist. And then what happened, of course, after the program grew and the audience became huge, even very well-known performers wanted to be on the program to be associated and to have that platform.
He had many messages to deliver about Christianity, this modern vision of Christianity.
Yes.
If you could boil it down to one or two messages that you heard over the years again and again, what would they be?
Well, I think he came up with a lot of catch slogans that he became famous for. But I think it was filling people's needs and showing them that God was a positive God, even though there were, he was criticized for not pushing the whole doctrine of hell, but he was being more of a pop psychologist to people. I think he got criticized for that. However, I think when in the end, it was proven that his message had a much broader a broader theological scope than people realized. He really had a very in-depth understanding of the Bible. He had a very upbringing from Iowa with his roots there with the Dutch Reform church that he was involved in. So he transitioned that into what I call an evangelical Bible-based message.
Mm-hmm. I understand you visited his home state of Iowa. You came to Iowa once or twice?
Oh, yes. We were up there several times. We would go up and visit his brother, Henry, who I believe still lives up in the Newkirk, Orange City area. We would go out to Alton, Iowa, and we would visit with Mrs. Schuller's family, the DeHaans, up in that area. And yeah, I've had, as a matter of fact, I remember one night we were speaking at a church up in Iowa, and there was a tornado alert, and we had to go down in the basement and hang out for about an hour and a half.
Mm. I wonder, after those visits with him to his home state of Iowa, if you understood better how his upbringing shaped him later in life.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There's no question about that. He was very, very proud of his Dutch heritage and his roots in Iowa. He attributes his upbringing on the Iowa farm for his grounded life and his work. He always talked about Iowa and the people from Iowa.
Okay, Michael Nason, thank you very much for sharing with us your remembrances of Reverend Robert Schuller. You're a close friend of him and have aided him for four decades or more, also former executive producer of The Hour of Power. Michael Nason, thank you for helping us celebrate his life.
Thank you very much for the time.
It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. As we usher in a new year, we look back at the lives of some Iowans who were lost in 2015. We offer this program as a tribute to all, whether notable to one or many, who died over the past year. And we invite you to share your remembrances of the Iowans who died this year and are close to your heart on our Facebook page. Another loss in 2015 was an inspiring mentor to generations of law students and a scholar who put Iowa law on the map in terms of international law and human rights. Burns Weston was one of the founders of the University of Iowa Center for Human Rights, and I talked with his colleague and friend, Greg Hammett, earlier this year. He started by describing how Weston got his start in international law.
And he did so by, well, you know, mammoth numbers of publications and lots of students who studied with Burns. But also he did it by enacting the courage of his conviction, going out to places like Israel for conflict mitigation, working in Korea and bringing home one of their dissidents after the during the dictatorship there in the 80s, who this man eventually became president of Korea. So Burns did it by not just staying in the ivory tower. He had the courage of his conviction to go out and do things, too, that put Iowa on the map.
Mm-hmm. So what have been the achievements of the Center for Human Rights at the University of Iowa since its co-founding by Burns Weston?
Burns went to then-Provost John Whitmore with the idea of, let's have a semester-long celebration for the 50th anniversary of the United Nations Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It was a great success, but when it was over, Burns looked at his colleagues, you know, Gina Kroshek and the late Rex Honey and Dorothy Paul, and said, well, what do we do now? And they said, well, let's start a center. And Rex said, I've got an extra desk in my office. And Burns said, well, get a phone and we'll get started. and we did. And it's in those 15 years, now 16 or 17, I guess, the center has grown to become, based on the University of Chicago's evaluation, one of the top 12 centers of human rights in the country. It's internationally renowned for the scholarship that comes from it. It also has educational programming. It has a certificate that is offered to any student in Iowa in human rights, but it's housed in the law school. And we also are mentors of the human rights track in the International Studies bachelor's degree program at Iowa, We also have the One Community, One Book program that has become wildly popular around the county and around the eastern part of the state. We brought in Brian Stevenson this past month. It was one of the last events Burns attended. Brian's Just Mercy is, you know, a New York Times bestseller. We were working with Geneva Campus Ministry and the City of Literature here in Iowa City, as well as the library. And so it has done quite a few things. We have a program called, for instance, Know Your Rights, which is a campaign to help newly arrived immigrants understand, you know, what it is that they have the right to once they get here. And just many, many other programs of that sort. So it started with a desk and a phone, and it's developed into a well-rounded program in both teaching, scholarship, and service to the community.
Greg, you knew him as a friend for many years as well as a colleague. Tell us about what he was like when he wasn't fighting for human rights as a friend.
Oh, well, Burns was, that was a whole other story for me and Burns. Burns and I were exactly 20 years and 1 week apart in age, and we always joked about that. And Burns and I had a common bond in the fine arts. Burns, few people know this, his closest friends know this, but he entered Oberlin College as a first-year student as a concert pianist major. And Burns was a wonderful piano player and a great connoisseur of the fine arts. But what was really interesting was he had the vision that human rights was not just a legal issue, an international law issue. It permeated all disciplines. And he and I agreed thoroughly on that, but particularly in the area of fine arts. And so in his 20 weeks or so, he was here every year. Splitting his time between here, his home in New York, and his wife Marta's home in Sweden, we would go to films or the theater or go to see a concert sometimes twice a weekend during the late fall and the winter. And it became kind of like more of my buddy than my colleague, actually. And in that sense, I will miss Burns dearly. He was a wonderful person to, and we never talked business when we went to these things. We always would go for coffee or whatever afterward and talk about the film or the concert and how it related to human rights, and how the human condition is edified by fine art, but it also is a reflection of our inhumanity towards each other. And it was just a wonderful bond we had. And the week before he passed away. On Sunday, he called me. He knew I had something. I have a back problem that needs surgery, and he called and said, "Greg, if you need anything, groceries or whatever, just let me know, and I'll come and get you, and we'll go to the store." And that's the kind of friendship we had. And I'm good. That's going to be a very hollow part of my life now with Burns gone.
Okay, Greg Hammett. Again, sorry for your loss, but thank you so much for helping us remember and celebrate the life of Burns Weston, who died this week at the age of 81. Thank you, Greg.
Ben, it's been a pleasure and an honor to speak with you today.
A conversation with Greg Hammett, reflecting on his colleague and friend, Burns Weston. Weston passed away October 29th at the age of 81. It's River to River from Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. This hour, we've been remembering deaths in the news in 2015. You might remember in mid-December of last year, a standout high school wrestler from Spencer, Iowa, died after collapsing earlier in the day. This came during a championship match at his hometown tournament. Austin Roberts was a returning state medalist. He fell to the mat after a stoppage in action in the final minute of the Spencer Invitational's 220-pound title match. An emergency response team tended to him at the tournament. He passed away later that night at Spencer High School. He passed away later that night at Spencer Hospital. It's the first Iowa high school wrestling-related death in recent memory. Joining us now, Adam Grass, Dean of Students of Spencer Middle School's co-head wrestling coach at Spencer High School. He was one of Austin's wrestling coaches. Adam, thank you for joining us. Can you tell us anything now at this point about the cause of Austin's death?
At this point right now, they're still working on trying to find some answers.
Mm-hmm. Do we know whether it was in any way... preventable? Were there warning signs?
No. No, there was no warning signs, and it wasn't anything that was injury related to wrestling or anything else other than just it happened at that point in time, kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about Austin Roberts. What kind of man he was?
Austin was a man, first off. I mean, he was 6'4", 220 pounds, big kid, strong kid, great athlete. But the thing that some people, you know, looking at him first sight wouldn't think of as Austin is he was kind of a big softy. He had a big heart and enjoyed life and was into cars and horses and was really an all-around gentleman of a man.
Mm-hmm. Do you remember any particular instances, or are there stories that really tell us what sort of person Austin was?
You know, on the wrestling mat, he was pretty intense, and obviously, like I said before, big, strong kid, and looked the part, and didn't matter who he was wrestling, if the kid was, you know, a returning state champion or, you know, a freshman that, you know, really wasn't up to Austin's wrestling ability or stature, but he always gave his all, and then I don't remember a match I ever coached with Austin or saw him wrestle in a match that he didn't pat the other kid on the back after the match was over. Enjoyed messing around with his buddies on the wrestling team and the football field, and he, talking with some of his family during the visitation and funeral times, you know, he enjoyed his little cousins, and they rode him around like a horse, and he was always playing around with them, and my own son, 5 years old, you know, kind of looked up to him like a big brother, so.
Mm-hmm. So, Adam, how did Austin get along with the team? What type of leadership did he show there?
He became literally our poster child. He is the center point of our poster this year, flexing behind the rest of the team. But he had embraced that role of leader this year and was, you know, our biggest fan on the bench, and kids on the rest of the high school team looked up to him and wanted to, you know, have the success that he was having. And I think a lot of people looked up to him, and I think he really was starting to embrace that role.
How is your community, the high school community, and also the community of Spencer, coping with the loss?
You know, the thing that we've kind of laid out for our wrestling team and have had great support from the community, Austin's family, even beyond Spencer itself, the state of Iowa and the nation, with the wrestling family is pretty tight-knit. But, you know, we're getting through it together. I mean, that's really all we can really do right now is help each other out in the good parts and the bad parts and the ugly parts. You know, we've received a lot of support from local high schools around our area across the state of Iowa. We've been contacted by numerous colleges and offering condolences, and we know we've got a lot of people that are making sure that we're okay.
Okay, that's good to hear. Adam Grass is, thank you very much for being with us, remembering Austin Roberts, an 18-year-old wrestler at Spencer High School, who died in mid-December after a match. Thank you, Adam.
Thank you.
Before we go this hour, a few others who passed away in 2015 connected with higher education in Iowa to remember. John Kamerick, University of Northern Iowa's sixth president, who served from 1970 to 1983, died this past year. During his time as president of UNI, many projects on the campus began, like the construction of the Communication Arts Center, which is named after Kamerick. Also, Schindler Education Center, the Physical Education Center, and the Unidome. He led UNI's transformation from a single teacher's college to a multi-college university. Kamerick was a veteran of World War II. He received the Victory Medal and one Battle Star for the Philippine Liberation and six Battle Stars for the Asia-Pacific Campaign. After retiring, he returned to UNI as a professor of history until his retirement. John Kamerick died on April 13th at the age of 95. Also, Michael Mick Ferrari died last year at the age of 75. Ferrari was president of Drake University from 1985 to 1998. He helped push the school to national prominence. He launched the Campaign for Drake. That was a $115 million national fundraising program to advance Drake for students and society. Ferrari died on May 15th. Also to remember, Melva Buxbaum,
a prominent Des Moines arts patron and philanthropist. She died of bladder cancer in 2015. She established the Buxbaum Distinguished Lecture Series at Drake University. It was in honor of her late husband, Martin. She established the Buxbaum Award, which grants an artist $100,000 and an invitation to exhibit at the Whitney every 2 years. An avid art fan, Melva Buxbaum was president of the Des Moines Arts Center Board and one of the world's leading art collectors. Melva Buxbaum died August 16th at the age of 82. And that brings to a close an hour remembering some notable Iowans who passed away in 2015. And once again, if you'd like to remember someone Iowa lost in 2015, please go to Iowa Public Radio's Facebook page and tell us about that person. River to River is produced by Claire Roth, Emily Woodbury, and Lindsay Moon. Catherine Perkins is our executive producer. We always welcome your comments and questions about this program. You can contact us anytime. Our email, rivertoriver@iowapublicradio.org. River to River is a production of Iowa Public Radio News. I'm Ben Kiefer. Thanks for joining us.